This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Professor Datuk Dr. Ibrahim Ahmad Bajunit is the Deputy Vice Chancellor and Professor of Management, Education and the Social Sciences at INTI International University. He is also the recipient of the 2010 National Education Leadership Award, and we're pleased to have him here in the studio for a conversation on teachers and education on this special Teachers' Day episode. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you.
So, we can't, get into a conversation about you as a teacher without asking. Tell us about your school days. What kind of student were you?
Great. I was, when we answer questions like, "Oh, what kind of student were you?" You can fictionalize your past, or you can be truthful to yourself, or you can continue trying to understand what you were at different stages of life. Well, I was a student. I was a learner. There were areas in which I was a leader. There were areas in which I was a follower. There were areas in which I excelled, and there were areas in which I struggled to learn. So it's a normal thing. So it's a kind of ordinary student.
Who were your favorite teachers at the time?
Oh, there were many. You see, we were very fortunate during my time because many of our teachers were foreigners. So we had teachers from Ireland, from England, from India, from Scotland. And so there were all these teachers earlier on when I was in the special Malay class. We had Malay teachers, and then later on, for transition going to the English medium schools, I had Chinese teachers and Indian teachers, and all the teachers they just loved their students. I mean, of course, those days they can cane the students, and nowadays it's going to be very difficult.
It's very frowned upon.
Yeah. So, but they were teaching students, and they wanted their students to excel. So there were many, many teachers, but my favorite English teacher was Mr. Ambrose. And later on, at sixth form, the teacher whom I really respect and love was Mrs. Hughes, the wife of the principal of Penang Free School. And then my geography teacher. And then my history teacher. And, every one of them was strong in their own area. And then when you go to university, you get enthralled, you get inspired by people like Professor Wong Gangwu, Professor Pluvia, and then later in the world of work, I was a teacher. So with me were the people from the Peace Corps who came as teachers, and also the Canadian Volunteer Service overseas, and the British Volunteer Service overseas, and we became good friends. So as you go through your life at secondary school level, at university level, and then in the university itself, you meet people from different... So when you meet people and you learn and you are inspired by people from different cultures, you are grateful to them, you build a worldview which is very receptive.
How does the relationship between teachers and students change at all these different stages that you're mentioning? Because I know for myself anyway that my relationship with my teachers from when I was in high school, or rather secondary school, to when I went to university, that was a very different relationship.
Right across the stages of life, one thing which I grapple with and which I try to promote in my role as a teacher now is to ensure that every child has the opportunity of extended conversation, because it is possible for a person to go through school life, university life, just to have a almost like objective question type of question and answer, without the in-depth extended conversation where the effect, besides the cognitive thing, the feelings come out.
And the context, I think.
And the context. So this extended conversation is so important because it makes for meaning in understanding, in the ways of knowing and understanding deeply. So I had the opportunity of having extended conversations at the primary level, at the secondary level, and particularly at Form 6 level, and then at the university level.
For yourself, when did you first realize that education was important?
It was intuitive. My father was a teacher. He was a religious teacher, and he was all the time emphasizing on education. My uncle, he was in the civil service. He was emphasizing on education, and most of the English books I read were actually from my uncle's library, and also from the Lincoln Library in Penang, and the Penang State Library. So when the schools had limited collections, these other libraries gave you the opportunity. But slightly earlier on, I grew up in Penang, Georgetown. There were so many Indian stores by the roadside where they have comics. So you read all kinds of Marvel comic books, like right now all the, Batman and Spider-Man and all the rest. They were all in the comics before in Marvel. And you read them and you begin to develop your vocabulary and then your imagination. Because as Einstein said, imagination is more important than intellect. So you develop imagination of other times, other spaces,
other people.
Cultures. Yep.
And when did you decide that you wanted to be a teacher? I mean, it clearly runs in the family. So was it something that you always thought of doing when you grew up?
Yeah, my concept of a teacher is beyond just teaching. From earlier on, because my father was writing dictionaries, he was a lexicographer, and he was a teacher. So my idea of a teacher, it's not just a teacher who goes and teach a subject, but it is holistic. It's a person who leads a community. It's a person who is also a writer. So a teacher is not just a knowledge manager, but is also a knowledge generator. So when I decided to go into teaching, it's not the conventional idea of going to a classroom, but it's about writing as well. It's about researching, and it's about leadership in the community. So from early on, while being a teacher, I was involved in the trade union movement and the teachers' trade union movement and the consumer association and the Sahabat Alam Malaysia, caring for the environment. So a teacher is, one doesn't limit the definition of a teacher to someone who goes into a classroom and teaches just a subject, it's more encompassing.
It's a more holistic approach, basically.
That's it.
Okay. What have you found to be the most rewarding aspect of being a teacher?
The success of my students. And when I say success, it's not just getting employment, but it's when my students become great contributors. They become people who contribute to the development of the country. They become people who contribute to solve some of the problems, whether technical, environmental, scientific, or social problems. So it's very rewarding to know that your students go on and they become really great, like one of my former students, in the sense that we were in the same school, is a professor who cares about the environment and who is leading nationally and in international bodies in environment and in some others in some other fields. So it's most rewarding.
In addition to your responsibilities as a vice chancellor and professor, you're also a columnist for a local national daily and a much sought after speaker and consultant. In fact, when we reached out to arrange this interview, your office said you even worked during holidays. You know, where and how did you acquire this work ethic?
My father actually, you see, many of the things you actually acquire most of your basic values from the home, from early years, and then you move on from the school, and then from the community, and from good media, not bad media, and then from your interactions with different people at different points of time.
How would you define good media as opposed to bad media?
Constructive. A leader can see all the negative things, but a leader must rise above the negativity of the now and create a hope and better vision. You see, like in the Muslim faith and also in other faith, they pray that today is better than yesterday, that tomorrow will be better than today. Leaders and teachers must do that. They must create faith and hope for better things, even if things are not going quite right now. But I just want to go back to that earlier point about
work ethic and getting...
Yeah. You see, once you love what you do, day and night, holidays and work days, they are the same. They merge. There's a blurring of it. And one of the Chinese philosophers said that when you enjoy your job, you just enjoy it when there's a perfect matching between what you are and your job. You just don't see any pressure. You don't see anything. You just enjoy doing it as part of a life mission, life purpose, a meaning of life, you know.
I'm speaking today to Professor Datuk Dr. Ibrahim Ahmad Bajanit, Deputy Vice Chancellor at INTI International University, for our Teachers' Day special. Coming up, we find out a little more of Datuk's take on the state of education in Malaysia today on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today, Professor Datuk Dr. Ibrahim Ahmad Bajanit. He was formerly the director of the Regional Center for Educational Planning at Al Sharjah in the United Arab Emirates, the founding dean of the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences at University Tun Abdul Razak, and director of the National Institute of Education Management and Leadership. And we are discussing Teachers' Day and the life of a teacher. So Malaysia recently came under a lot of criticism for performing poorly on international assessments like the PISA and TIMSS ranking. What is your take on the state of education in Malaysia today?
You see, earlier on in the 70s, we were very reluctant to get involved in international comparisons and measures, etc. But in the 90s, we were bold enough because we became more confident as a nation. Now, we should not measure the state of education just by some instruments or some criteria established whether by local bodies or international bodies, because education is so vast and so complex that measures are always never holistic, never complete. Measures of PISA and TIMSS, and we haven't gone into PIRLS, P-I-R-L-S, and we haven't gone into some other measures. At the university level, we have the Global Times ranking and the Shanghai ranking. So when we take the whole system of education, we do have to measure, basically, there are so many ways of measuring so many things. Basically, it's what are the educational deficits and what are the educational assets? Now, if we take the economic perspective, we measure them in terms of investment and return on investment. If we take the sociological perspective, we might want to measure social capital or relationship capital. And social capital is about bonding, linking, bridging. Social capital is about, do you trust your fellow citizens? Do you trust the government and the institutions of government. All those things are not really measured. We have begun to put the index of the quality of life. Now, so when we measure, we seem to measure according to the exam results.
Yeah.
Previously at Form 3, Form 5. So we talk about input, process, output. And we have begun to talk about outcomes. But then there's the longer term outcomes. What kind of citizens do our students make? They may not be the richest, the most successful, but what's the index of happiness in our country? Did our education system enable people to be happy at whichever socioeconomic position they are? Or does our education system create future generations who respect each other and who care for each other, who care for the society, who care for the environment? These are other measures which we have not really developed. So we should not be sidetracked by the media bliss, by the media focus on teams and world rankings and all the rest. As an education system, if we look at the quality of our leaders now at all levels, they were the products of our education system before. So even before we spoke about the OECD measures and other measures, and we do have some very, very good leaders at the national and international level. We do have so many inspiring people. So the education system, as we have inherited, is actually a good system because we are fortunate. We inherited an education system from the British model, which was actually the elitist Oxbridge model. So when we had our University of Malaya, it was an Oxford-Cambridge model, very elitist. And that's why when we developed our other universities, we already had the benchmarks. And compared to many other countries which didn't have that kind of model, our model at the higher education level was okay now. Our model at the school level was also, we had premier schools. Like St. George's, Penang Free School, Malay College, Kuala Kangsa. They were also very, very good models. And then later on, we had our other residential schools. So we created an education system which we inherited from a very mature model. And we went ahead. But then we moved into the democratization of education. Basically, it's the three concepts: universal education at the primary level, and then mass education at the secondary level, and then elitist education at the university level. However, what we have done in the 1990s was to declare three things. Really fantastic policy shift. One is the democratization of higher education, which means it was before universal primary education. Now we say we can provide universal higher education, democratization of higher education. Second, Malaysia is a center of educational excellence. So we are, in some ways, a leading nation in education. When we take the 194 nations of the world and all the rest, we're still okay. But if you measure specifics like mathematics mastery or English or history, then it's a different thing. But if you take it as a whole, we are not doing too badly. And then the third thing that we have put in place, first, democratization of higher education, and Malaysia is a center of educational excellence. And the third is lifelong learning. So if you miss out earlier at Form 5, Form 6 level, then you still have the opportunity throughout your life to continue. Because of the lifelong learning policy we have accepted. But there's also this other thing in Malaysia which is neglected, because while in all the documents is about education and training, we forget training. We are one of those nations in the world which really devote so much time in training, on training, whether in the government sector or the private sector. In fact, the training initiatives in our country are the initiatives which make us realize the policy of lifelong learning.
Going from looking at the system to the people within it, what can we do or what are we doing to improve the quality of teachers within our school system?
We have many, many interesting challenges. One challenge which we intervene with is the entry level. To get people who come into teaching who are as good as all those who go into the other professions, law, medicine, engineering. So we get people into teaching with those basic, strong qualifications. Second, we have to we do interviews and we do have instruments to measure, to mesh the aptitude for the profession. If you want to be a medical doctor or lawyer, you must have the aptitude for those professions. Likewise, you must have the aptitude and the attitude of wanting to be in the teaching profession. But then we do have some other challenges which are not just specific to education, but because there are more ladies, more women in all the universities, in the various faculties, not just in Malaysia, but also worldwide. Then there is this challenge of gender in the teaching profession. That is a difficult challenge because we have to be fair to women, but at the same time, we have to ensure that boys in the school system do have male role models. But if we have a school where there are, the majority are women and it's a boys' school, then we have the psychological problem of of lack of male models. So these are some of the psychological and sociological issues we have not handled.
Our Deputy Prime Minister and Education Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin said that rankings are not a good basis for excellent education. What makes a good university, in your opinion?
You see, basically, we get muddled in our thinking over two things. Policies and practice. So we have to be clear about policies. Policies are normally the macro things. Policies set the conditions. But practice is about professionalism. And what the most sacred and the most important matter in the education process is the relationship between the teacher and the learner at all levels, and also the conditions of teaching learning. And in the curriculum world, they speak about the formal curriculum, that which is prepared by the government, and then the instructional curriculum, that which is interpreted by the teacher teaching, whether university lecturer or teacher, and the operational curriculum, the conditions under which the teacher and the learner interact, whether in the afternoon or in the morning, whether they use technology or they don't use technology, whether they are is a very experienced lecturer or teacher or just someone who just graduated. That's the operational curriculum. And then the experiential curriculum. The learner with his or her multiple intelligences who take away whatever that they are learning from the formal thing. So that's the curriculum process. And you see, when we talk about policies, when we talk about national competition, we're talking at a macro level. But what really matters in the final analysis is what that single learner becomes, achieve, accomplish, attain, And later, and most important, contribute and give back to society. That is what makes a good education system. I would say, in the final analysis, how the person becomes a participative a member of the community, of the nation, and of global citizenry.
Do our public universities have sufficient autonomy?
Autonomy is a controversial, almost paradoxical, whether public or private, whether in the education sector or in any other sector. While autonomy is an ideal, there has to be a balance. There's autonomy in the culture. It is about culture, actually. Is the broader culture, wider culture in society, and then it goes to the profession, and then it goes to the organization itself, and then it goes to the leadership. You can talk about autonomy in the abstract, but if you have the leaders and the management of the organization who are authoritarian or who have some personalities which don't permit too much autonomy, so the society as a whole can celebrate autonomy, but it doesn't operate too well in particular institutions. So autonomy is an ideal. It is like democracy. It's
something to aspire towards.
Yeah, but it's never achieved except for in the best organizations, which have strong traditions. And when you select the creme de la creme, the best of the best, then we go somewhere. The question of autonomy is actually related to other bigger questions in the culture.
Earlier you mentioned the three sort of big sea changes that happened in the 90s, one of which was that Malaysia emerged as a place of educational excellence. Are our priorities misplaced by aspiring to be an educational hub without necessarily having stellar universities?
Oh, no, we do have stellar universities. But how stellar they are, those universities are, is not determined just by the world ranking of Times and Shanghai. We can go back further to say that the foundations of our stellar university, like University Malaya, were actually the Oxbridge model. The model was already there. It's sustaining excellence of the university and then replicating it with our other universities. What has happened is this. Our University of Malaya is really, you see, when you say ranking, you can talk about the 50, the 100, or the 200, or the 500. We are in the top when you take the 500. Okay, and after all, there are thousands of universities in the world. To be in the 500 or 1,000 is actually good. But when we want to be in the top 50, that is a worthwhile aspiration. But then we should not be paranoid about about the rankings. Because if you're paranoid, just take that example. In a class of 40 students, there'll be, the number one, number two, and then number 40. It doesn't mean that if you're number 40, you're no good. You can be good in so many different ways. We do have stellar universities. Now, what has happened is this. We have the five research universities, six. They are stellar universities. And then we have the other universities. In fact, when University Science was established and also University Kebangsaan, many of the lecturers from University Malaya used to fly to USM and teach until they built their own academic faculties. And then later, University Kebangsaan lecturers were helping the other universities. So now we have the older universities, the stellar universities, helping the state universities, which are developing their own people. And also we have our academicians being trained abroad, and they are as good as other academicians abroad. So we do have stellar universities, but we do have universities which are fledglings. They're beginning to grow. And they'll take time to grow, and that's okay because they have the benchmarks within the country and internationally.
You've also written more than 500 articles on subjects ranging from education to developing human capital. Do we place enough emphasis on research output?
We are beginning to. We can say the last 20 years, it was the individuals who on their own, from University of Malaya, the National University and all the rest, it was on their own and they didn't have much support. But during the last, particularly the last 10 years, we have been driving research, and we are beginning to move strongly in the research area. So it's research, development, innovation, commercialization. And we are getting there, and the focus is there. But we, of course, have to admit that we never supported research very holistically and very strongly in the past. But we are getting there now. And almost everywhere, people are under pressure because they are asked to do research. And now the challenge will be not research, but the quality of the research. Whether people go through the motions of producing papers, publishing papers, doing research, or whether they are doing something which is breakthrough and on the edge of knowledge, creating new knowledge.
Earlier, you also mentioned your views on teachers, or rather of teaching being something that is lifelong, not just something that happens in a classroom. So as a professor, as somebody who has worked professionally as a teacher for so many years, and now as a deputy vice chancellor, what educational philosophy are you instilling or hoping to instill?
Actually, it's lifelong learning. And you know, most of the things that we want to say about education, some of the greatest philosophers have said during the last 3,000 years of human civilization, Confucius, Lao Tzu, Ibn Khaldun, all the prophets and all the great gurus and professors of the past, they have said most of the things that we say in different ways. But basically, Socrates said it all. When asked, "Why are you so wise?" he said, "It's because I know I do not know." We must begin not from a position of arrogance and know-all, but we begin from a position that, yes, we know a little, but not enough. Yes, we are ignorant in so many areas, and then we need to pursue further. Now, for instance, we're beginning to move. We became very strong in particular disciplines of knowledge, the realms of knowledge. But we go deeper, and it's intradisciplinary, and then interdisciplinary, and multidisciplinary. And then now we're going transdisciplinary. So if you're learning engineering, you just don't do civil engineering. You begin to do and have a basic understanding of mechanical and electrical engineering. If you do architecture, you also begin to know about the landscape planning and all these other things. So crossover. And better still is what one of the seminal works, one of the best authors who dealt with this matter, C.C. Snow. He wrote about the two cultures, the cultures of the arts and the science, where you, at the level of the academician and the knowledge person, you understand that the best of the arts have within them the sciences. You cannot produce a great work of art without understanding embedded in them are the sciences. And the best works of the sciences have so much artistry and beauty in them. So once you have that, and you know that there's so much to learn and so much to cross over the various disciplines, that's the way for human civilization to go.
Race and religion have been dominating our newspaper headlines recently. I say recently, but realistically, it's been a very long time that it's been kind of on the front pages. What role can education and teachers play in this ongoing debate?
In fact, that is one of the greatest challenges of education, to this person who has shaped the thinking of educators now. There are so many people who have shaped the thinking of educators, and we name them among the 50 most influential people, etc. So in education, we have people like Jean Piaget, Noam Chomsky, Zaba in Malaysia. So we have this person, Howard Gardner, who came out with the theory of multiple intelligences. So intelligences are not verbal linguistic intelligences or logical mathematical intelligences, but there are many different kinds. Now, he came out with a book, Five Minds for the Future. The first mind is the disciplined mind. Second mind is the synthesizing mind. And the third mind is the creative mind. But among the most two other minds, one is the respectful mind, to respect people who are different from you, to respect the other, to respect other people's, not to deny other people's rights. So it's a respectful mind, and then the ethical mind. So that's one of the greatest challenges of education, because religion is about belief. In the Quran, it is stated the respect you and your religion and I with my religion. There is no compulsion in religion. That is the teaching of Islam, actually. But as in all religions, the basic teaching can get distorted when you have the politics of religion. Race, the idea of race, Malaysia was one of the first nations which objected against apartheid. Tengku Abdul Rahman was the one who took a stand. So we took a stand throughout, and that's why Nelson Mandela was always positive about Malaysia, Malaysian leaders. We took that stand. Now, and of course, Abraham Lincoln, America went to war. They had the Civil War. Because they wanted to abolish slavery. So the race issue continues. It's fundamental. It's tribalism. It's racial tribalism. And so that is again the challenge to mankind. But, just imagine if a meteor were to hit our Earth, and there's going to be the destruction of humanity or of life. Diseases which have killed millions, like the Black Plague and all the rest, then these two things, religion and race, may not be in the minds of those supremacists. It's survival which becomes more important. But that's, we can't say that, it's only under crisis that people should come together. But under normal circumstances, education should enlighten people so that they can rise above the primordial instincts.
And I suppose we also go back to that earlier point about, seeing beyond negativity and looking towards tomorrow. Finally, what message would you like to leave us with on Teachers' Day?
Teaching is a noble profession. Teachers should be noble. And teachers are colorblind, race blind in that sense, and irrespective of whether your children are black or yellow or brown, they come from families who are from different religions or without religion, the role of the teacher is actually to care about the learner, the individual, and to allow the individual to discover himself or herself, and to liberate, because education is about the liberation of trapped minds, and teachers should not be the oppressors, it should not be the pedagogy of the teachers should love and care for their learners and allow them to grow. And teachers should share the universal values of mankind and the heritage of human civilization, and build the younger people so that they become strong and move forward to improve our destinies.
Thank you very much, Professor. I've been speaking to Professor Datuk Dr. Ibrahim Ahmad Bajunit, Deputy Vice Chancellor at INTI International University, for our Teachers' Day special. You've been listening to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.